It is 8:30, and we have with us live in the studio Maria Tomczyk, co-editor at Eat the State. Good morning. No job this week. He's on the road, right?
That's right. He's actually taking another vacation.
Another vacation. Boy, he's getting a lot of vacations.
Well, his earlier vacation was a working vacation.
Oh, this is a vacation,
which everyone has to have once in a while.
I guess he's allowed. So we just wanted to say a big hello and thank you to all the people we saw at Rolling Thunder last week.
Yeah, it was great. I'm really happy that folks came by the table and told me what you thought of the show and of the newspaper and had some good suggestions on what we could do or not do or do more of in the future.
Yeah.
That was really nice.
Appreciate the feedback, too, and luckily the swelling has gone down, so...
Oh, I didn't see that part. I must have been talking to somebody very earnestly when that happened.
So this week we've been covering the streetcar, the potential boondoggle for South Lake Union, and there's a big vote coming up this week on the committee.
It's Tuesday in the Transportation Committee. Folks should call up your city council members. They're listed in the blue pages in the phone book, and tell them exactly what you think about the streetcar so that they'll have some good public feedback before they sit down and decide whether or not to pass Richard Conlon's plan.
So, yeah, not that they'll necessarily listen to everything, but they always like to say that they've gotten a lot of feedback on things. And they do. And, you know,
it can be effective if you're reasonable.
Oh, definitely can. No, I agree.
Yeah, if you're reasonable and you're well-spoken or if you send them an email and your writing's clear and brief and your points are well-considered, then sometimes it has an effect. It'll sway a council member, and that might be all it takes to get the vote changed.
No, I agree. I was being bad on that. You should always call up our representatives and let them know what you think. Speaking of which, this week in King County, there was a court ruling.
Yeah, in the King County Superior Court, Judge William Downing ruled on a case that would make gay marriage legal in the state of Washington. He was basically ruling on the constitutionality under Washington State's constitution of the act that was passed in the late 1980s, the Defense of Marriage Act here in the state of Washington. And a group of gay folks who want to get married in the state of Washington had brought this suit saying that that act was unconstitutional. And Judge Downing looked at it, and he considered it very carefully. And he came back with what is a very clear and very important ruling saying that, yes, the Defense of Marriage Act is unconstitutional. And it's interesting. What I found interesting about his ruling is that he takes the argument, that probably the main argument that most people who are against gay marriage make, that the institution of marriage really is necessary for heterosexuals to get together and have children and continue the human race, et cetera, et cetera. And he basically said that gay marriage is no threat to that. He said that the threats to marriage come from within the institution itself, and that any judge who has you know, presided in divorce court and over custody cases, et cetera, knows that. And that, in fact, gay marriage would allow the act of procreation, the continuation of the human race to occur just fine, and that it would actually help that. And it's interesting that this, it's kind of interesting because he's basically saying here that sex is not marriage, which is true. I mean, anybody knows that that's true, that sex is not marriage, just because of so many people who have children out of wedlock. And it also acknowledges that gay people, too, have children, and that it doesn't necessarily involve a heterosexual relationship for people to have and raise children. And it was very interesting and a very, very important decision. However, he had said that his ruling would not allow municipalities in the state to issue marriage licenses, that he put that aspect of it on hold so that the state Supreme Court could actually sit down and look at this and rule on it first. So that's where we're at with it.
All right. Also this week, Ron Sims was in the news. He had proposed a radical income tax for Washington as part of his platform for running for governor.
Oh, yeah. I think it's a mark of desperation, really. I mean, a lot of folks are already considering Christine Gregoire as the Democratic candidate for governor. Ron Sims has also declared in the race, but he must be having a really hard time getting donations and getting any kind of media attention, because he's come out with this tax plan that says he would like to, and initially I thought it was great, sure, okay, let's have a state tax, let's have a state income tax. That's what we need. You know, I mean, we've had a couple different groups look at it and say that over and over again, what we really need is a much fairer tax system, and the way to get that is a state income tax, get rid of the sales tax, you know, really bring down people's property taxes and tax income, you know, so that then it's not just poor people paying the bulk of the state taxes through the sales tax, that it's a fair system. And I thought that was great. You know, he wants to do that. He wants to get rid of the state sales tax, and he wants to lower property taxes, and he'd impose a graduated income tax for individuals that would go from 4% to 10% of your income. However, this week he said, well, for the business part of it, he wants to eliminate the business's B&O tax, the business and occupation tax, which is okay, because the business and occupation tax is not very fair either. It taxes your gross receipts, so everything that the business brings in, all the income that the business brings in, and it doesn't tax the business's profits, which is your income minus your expenses, which can be a real burden for some businesses, and particularly in years when you have a lot of expenses like capital expenses and stuff. It can be a real problem to have to pay tax on your income but not on your profit. However, he turned around and he said, I wouldn't just want to get rid of the B&O tax and replace it with a business income tax, which would tax business profits. He wants to not have a business income tax either. So he's saying zero taxes for business. Now I think that's got to be because he hasn't gotten the kind of donations he's been looking for, because I can't see why anybody in their right mind would propose that. I just don't understand it.
Yeah, it just seems to be mirroring, you know, what they're doing at the federal level. It's just,
yeah, it's
reduce
not
the taxes on the rich.
Yeah, it's interesting. I wonder why he's running as a Democrat. Why he isn't running against Dino Rossi as a Republican?
Well, maybe
with that kind of a plan.
Yeah, maybe that'll become evident over time. Okay, jump into national stuff. I know you, just like I, earlier this week, as soon as we heard the orange alert, I was up there putting more, plastic over my windows and putting up the sandbags in front of the house.
Filling your water bottles.
Yeah.
Checking the first aid kits.
Yeah.
Actually, no, I wasn't doing that.
Huh.
In fact, the day it was announced, I did what I always do, which is I read the article straight through to the end. And I went on the web and I looked for some other information, and I read those news articles and announcements all the way through to the end. And it seems our homeland commissar, Tom Ridge, I guess that, you know, whatever his title is, he has been criticized in the past for being really vague about these terrorist alerts. And so this time around, we got some specific information. They said these five different buildings are being targeted, you know, and the threat is imminent and it's real. And we have, you know, we've seen that they've taken photos and cased the places, and they've done these drills that would involve using a truck bomb and everything. And I read through that. And, you know, that wasn't clear at all. I mean, those were things that we heard these folks say, but they didn't provide any evidence. They didn't provide any details. And when reporters asked them, have you seen the photos, the surveillance photos that were taken, they backed off and said, no, we actually haven't seen the raw intelligence. We haven't seen the raw data. And when reporters asked them, oh, really? So who did these little, you know, truck bomb exercises? Did you arrest those guys? You know, did you find another cell of terrorists that we haven't heard anything about, that John Ashcroft hasn't stood up in front of a camera and announced the arrest of, you know, 10 people in New York City and Washington, D.C.? And the Homeland Security folks said, well, no. And so it left you with this feeling of, yeah, did they make this up? You know, where did they get this information? And lo and behold, the next day, the New York Times comes out with an article saying it's old data that's 3 or 4 years old. And everybody, I don't know about you, but I mean, I kind of take a little informal poll when I ride the bus and I listen to people talk about these kind of things. And I think my little informal polls are much more informative than a lot of the national polls, in that they're skewed in their questions and so forth. Because I just sit and I listen to what people are saying after they've read the newspaper or they've heard things on the radio and the TV. And by Tuesday and Wednesday, folks were disgusted. Basically saying, look, you know, they do this for political reasons. It has no meaning, and it's just a lie. It's insane. And the interesting thing about it is that by Friday, the Homeland Security people were coming back out and saying, oh, no, look, this is important data, and some of this stuff was updated in January. And yet when reporters questioned them about it and said, really, were new surveillance photos taken in January? The number two guy at the Homeland Security Agency, Tom, I think his name is James Loy, said, I actually haven't seen any of the surveillance photos, so I don't know if new photos were taken in January. And when they asked him for details, well, what did they do in January? What did Al-Qaeda members do in January? James Loy told them. He said, look, this data is based on a guy that we've captured in Pakistan who we know was associated with Al-Qaeda. He had this information on his computers. It was 3 to 4 years old, dated to before the September 11th attacks, and it looked like at least one of the files relating to one of the buildings had been opened in January on his computer. That's all he could say. He couldn't say whether the file had been updated or he hadn't seen any of the photos. He didn't know anything about truck bomb exercises. That little detail somehow just disappeared out of all the updates on this security alert and everything. So you got to wonder. It's like what good is the Homeland Security Agency for other than as a little political propaganda office to cover up for the Bush administration? And you know, the Bush administration has had a lot of things they would like to get our minds off of this week, you know, including things like high oil prices, very bad economic data that's been released this week, and the war in Iraq, how badly it's unraveling, things like the $25 billion that Bush just signed into law to pay for the war in Iraq, you know, an additional $25 billion, and for things like George Bush not really acting fully on the September 11th commission's recommendations. All that stuff has been really bad news for him, and so how does he respond? With a terror alert.
Well, I was going to say, one of the things, and we'll, I guess this is a good time to go into it, big things that did come out in the news this week. It was just yesterday they were talking about the number of jobs that came out in July weren't quite as good. And I was thinking maybe a Department of Homeland Security, that's kind of their hope, is that's going to be a big job generator. You know, that's how they're going to save things.
I don't think so. I mean, in the city of New York, for example, they were really upset by this heightened security alert based on outdated information, because it meant that they had to pay overtime to all these police, and they're short-staffed because of the war in Iraq. A lot of police are National Guard Reserve, and so a lot of those guys got called up and are sent over, and they're in Iraq right now. And so the New York City Police are like 4,000 members short right now, and so they had to go out and do overtime for this phony terrorist alert. Now, in the meantime, the economy's not been doing so well. That was one of the things that I think George Bush had to scramble to cover up for this week. There were several reports released on various economic indicators, including consumer spending, which is down sharply. Now, consumer confidence is the indicator that gets reported on a lot. Consumer confidence basically tracks how people feel about the economy and whether they feel like they want to spend money, whereas consumer spending tracks what people actually do. So the difference between what people feel versus what they do is a very, very important one, and the one that's really key to how the economy is going to be doing in the future is what people actually do with their money, and that's consumer spending. Turns out that is in a slump, unless, of course, you're a rich person. The retailers that deal with luxury items like boats and yachts and really high-end cars, high-end jewelry. Nordstrom's, for example, did just great. And, excuse me, a lot of economists are saying, oh, it's because Nordstrom's had a big sale. Well, every retailer's had big sales in the last couple of months. Nordstrom's did well because that's where rich people shop. All the other retailers did very, very poorly.
And it makes them feel good when they shop there.
Yeah, and it's not just consumer spending that's down. Unemployment figures have been really bad, too, as you mentioned, Mike. Economists expected there to be about 200 and somewhere around 250,000 new jobs last month. There were about 32,000. And then also the figures for May and June, which had been, you know, hyped up and announced very happily by the Bush administration, those figures were revised downward. That does happen. Occasionally the figures are announced, and then later on they get more actual data in instead of estimates, and it turns out that, gosh, it wasn't what we thought it was. It's actually a lot less. That happened, too. So this week you had economists saying, well, the economy's in a soft patch, you know, and you hear that over and over again, and you start to ask yourself, what's a soft patch versus a sinkhole, you know? When does a soft patch become a mire? And
actually drive into it.
Yeah, I think an answer to that question is it can become a mire when the price of oil goes over $40 a barrel to historic highs. That was another thing that happened this week. The price of oil hit a historic high of $44 a barrel, and now economists are saying, gosh, it could go to $50 a barrel, which is unheard of. There's some reasons for that, not the least of which is the war in Iraq. But some of the other reasons for it have to do with things like increased consumption, folks who drive on the freeway, and if you're driving your little fuel-efficient hybrid and you look around you, you might find it really hard to see around all the SUVs in front of you, beside you, and behind you. That's part of why the price of oil is so high, is because people drive those things and have bought those things, and the auto industry has pushed those things. And the government will not regulate the fuel economy for sport utility vehicles or pickup trucks, which I think is a crime. Now, in addition, we're not the only nation who buys and drives those things. In China, the world's most populous country, people are starting to buy and drive them as well. And Chinese oil consumption has skyrocketed, so it's put more demand out there at a time when supply has become tighter. There are several reasons why supply has become tighter. One has to do with the fact that there are only limited amounts of oil reserves in the world, and there's also only a limited amount of capacity. So capacity is the ability to pull that oil out of the ground, ship it to the refineries, for the refineries to refine it, and then capacity for it to be shipped to the gas stations. So that capacity is limited, and the ability to increase that capacity has been limited too, because it was pretty much well taxed before we started the war. Nations around the world, particularly Saudi Arabia, had almost reached their full capacity. Saudi Arabia said they had more capacity, enough to compensate for the war. However, that hasn't turned out to be true, particularly since after the invasion, Iraq's oil supplies have largely come offline. Now, you might hear things like, occasionally you see the little article saying, oh, Iraq is shipping 2 million barrels a day or whatever. That's not true. Iraq is shipping half or less than that. They're just telling you what they think the estimates are for how much capacity Iraq can do in a rosy scenario. Iraq is shipping less than half of the low projections. The Bush administration had said, if you let us do this war, we'll have Iraq shipping 3 to 4 million barrels a day. They've not come anywhere near that. So having Iraq offline, having labor unrest in Nigeria, having political problems in Venezuela, which have been encouraged and pushed by the Bush administration. The Bush administration likes to see political unrest in Venezuela because they're hoping to get rid of Hugo Chavez. Unfortunately, that's had an effect on world oil prices. And you add on top of that developments in the last couple of weeks in Russia, where the head of Yukos, the state-owned oil company, has been thrown into prison, and these massive fines have been levied on Yukos for not paying their taxes, then you've got a real problem. So what happens when the price of oil goes over $40 a barrel? Well, a number of things happen. People stop spending extra money at the store because they're spending their extra money filling up the tank of the SUV. So that's one of the reasons why consumer spending is down. Another very important thing happens. Businesses have to spend more to ship goods and to move their people around. And when that happens, if that happens for a long period of time, then businesses have to recoup that expense somehow, and they raise the prices of their goods and services. What happens when the prices of goods and services go up across the board? Well, that's called inflation. And once you start inflation going, you can get into an inflationary cycle where the price of goods goes up, businesses because that inflation is being caused by something that's not that doesn't have to do with labor tend to squeeze the amount of money that they pay to their workers so that they don't give raises and they don't give bonuses because they're trying to get as much profit as they can out of the business, you know. That increase in prices is going to pay for oil. It's not going to pay for salaries. So people are not making more money, yet they're having to pay higher prices at the store. They stop spending. Businesses are not bringing in a lot of money because people are not buying stuff. They have to raise prices some more, et cetera, et cetera. That's what an inflationary spiral is. So that's what we're looking at as a problem down the road. And that's why when the price of oil shoots up like it has this week, you see Alan Greenspan on TV saying, oh, no, no, I think we're not going to have to raise interest rates to control inflation. I think inflation's right on track where we think it should be, et cetera, et cetera. So that's one of the reasons why economists say, oh, the price of oil is up. We have to talk to Alan Greenspan. But inflation can come on very, very quickly. And just because it's not happened yet doesn't mean it won't happen. So that's something folks should keep their eye on in the future.
Mm. Yeah, I think they have a red phone in the White House now instead of to the Soviet Union. It's now to Alan Greenspan.
So. Yeah, the Fed hotline.
Okay, anything else on the economy?
No, let's move to This Week in Iraq.
All right, that takes us to This Week in Iraq. This Week in Iraq.
Yeah, and the security situation there is unraveling fast. Bush has to cover up for this because this is not a good week in Iraq. Guerrillas made a bid to take over the city of Mosul, which is Iraq's third largest city in the north of the country. On Wednesday, guerrillas attacked the Iraqi police stations and Iraqi National Guard units in Mosul in the center of the city, in the north of the city, and in the south of the city. The fighting was intense, but it was quickly driven from the headlines by a second Shiite uprising in the south of the country. When U.S. Marines, there's been a redeployment of forces in Iraq, a new U.S. Marine expeditionary unit or expeditionary brigade posted in the south of the country near the city of Najaf, which is Muqtada al-Sadr's headquarters. They've decided that they're not happy with the fact that the U.S. military had ceded the city of Najaf over to Muqtada al-Sadr in April, basically surrendered that territory to him the same way the city of Fallujah was surrendered to the insurgents earlier this year. And they decided, gosh, you know, we're going to try and take that back. So they arrested an al-Sadr aide in Karbala last weekend, and then U.S. Marine tanks went into Najaf and attempted to surround al-Sadr's home, and they met very heavy fire from the Mahdi Army militia, which guards al-Sadr and is basically composed of most of his supporters. And then, of course, what happened is what could have been expected, what it seems that U.S. forces didn't anticipate. The call went out. They're trying to kill Muqtada al-Sadr. You know, everybody turn out on the street, bring your guns, blah, 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 blah. And busloads of young men poured into the Najaf area. And Muqtada al-Sadr's supporters in cities of Basra, Karbala, Kut, Nasiriya, Amara, and Baghdad, and Najaf all rose up and started fighting against Iraqi police, Iraqi National Guard units, and the U.S. forces. Now, it was things were so bad by Thursday and Friday that the U.S. planes were dropping bombs over the Sadr City neighborhood of Baghdad. Now, in Sadr City, in Baghdad, there are 2.5 million people who live there. They're all Shiites, and the vast majority of them are supporters of Muqtada al-Sadr. Now, that part of Baghdad is not under the control of the Iraqi government or U.S. forces, and hasn't been for some time. It's under the control of Muqtada al-Sadr's militia, the Mahdi Army, pretty much patrols the streets. There are a few Iraqi police that patrol the streets in Sadr City, but they take their orders from the Mahdi Army. And the fact that the U.S. Army had, that the U.S. military had to send planes over the city of Baghdad and drop bombs over the crowded, over the most crowded neighborhood in the city really tells you how bad the uprising is and how bad the security situation is and how little control U.S. troops have at this point. So that is a mess that is evolving and deteriorating rapidly. In other news, in Iraq, Ahmed Chalabi's nephew, Salem Chalabi, he's the guy who put together the, helped to, with another attorney, to put together the new constitution for Iraq. He's also the guy who is in charge of the, he's in charge of the tribunal that's going to try Saddam Hussein and some of his cohorts for war crimes. Well, it turns out that Salem Chalabi is under investigation for murder himself. He's suspected of ordering the death of a finance ministry official, an Iraqi finance ministry official, who was investigating, investigating the Chalabi family's real estate holdings. Now, when exile groups returned to Iraq after the fall of Saddam Hussein's government, a lot of them just moved into Iraqi government buildings and seized a whole bunch of Iraqi government property. Now, the new Iraqi government is trying to get that property back, and it turns out one of the biggest scofflaws has been the Chalabi family and their group, the Iraqi National Congress. And the guy who was investigating that, in charge of the investigation, was very, very afraid that he was going to be assassinated, and in fact, he was killed. And now they're investigating that, his death, and they're thinking that it was a member of the Chalabi family who ordered and arranged for his death, and they're thinking that it might have been Salem Chalabi, the guy who's going to try Saddam Hussein. So we'll see how that develops too. And then the Washington Post reported on Wednesday this week that almost $2 billion of Iraqi oil fund money has been used to pay American companies in Iraq, not to pay Iraqi companies, and that much of that work has been done to further the occupation of Iraq, to prosecute the war and not for reconstruction. Now, it appears that whenever the Coalition Provisional Authority wanted to avoid the bidding process and any oversight for their expenditures, instead of using U.S. money, they turned to the Iraqi oil fund money that the CPA violated its own rules by authorizing Iraqi money be spent when Iraqi representatives were not at the meetings to approve the expenditures. They often did it when they didn't have a quorum of members at their meeting, of the people who were overseeing the Iraqi oil fund money. One of the biggest recipients of that money was Kellogg Brown and Root, the Halliburton subsidiary, which got $1.66 billion to import fuel from Kuwait into Iraq. Among the other recipients was the Harris Corp, $48 million to set up a state-owned media network that's largely been viewed as a propaganda unit for the U.S. military. Another $16.8 million went to Custer Battles Company to provide security for the main U.S. military base in Baghdad. That has absolutely nothing to do with funding the Iraqi government or reconstruction. And Steve Doering Services of America got Iraqi oil money. NOR USA got Iraqi oil money. NOR USA has been linked to Ahmed Chalabi, and it's one of its main partners is a close friend of Ahmed Chalabi. And it appears that the Coalition Provisional Authority didn't even keep any paperwork on at least five contracts that totaled almost $1 billion. Would have been nice to know what that money went for. My guess is it went for things that Iraqis would not want to pay for, like, for example, keeping up the Abu Ghraib prison or paying bribes and so forth.
All right. Well, With that, we are unfortunately out of time. Talking once again with Maria Tomchik, co-editor of Eat the State. And Maria, quickly, where do people find Eat the State?
Eat the State can be found in bookstores, coffee shops, cafes, and other places where you find free publications around town. We can be found on the web at www.eatthestate.org. And if you have questions, comments, tips, you want to give us a little information on stories we should be covering, you can give us a call at 206-903-9461.